This relevant radio program is brought to you by the Catholic University of America, cultivating Catholic minds for 130 years and now offering an education certification titled Catholic Social Doctrine. Class materials and registration is available online at no cost at csdcertificate.com.
The following is a relevant radio program and is protected under U.S. copyright laws. This program is made possible through the contributions of listeners like you. Support Relevant Radio by clicking on the donate icon at www.relevantradio.com.
All the issues, all the topics, one place. From Maui to Maine, Phoenix to Philadelphia, and Eau Claire to the OC, this is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
This thing is trading above, what, 2,200 last time we looked? That's ridiculous.
It's on a run. You know what this reflects? It's becoming mainstream.
There's nothing mainstream about this thing. I can't go out to the hot dog vendor and use Bitcoin. And besides, how can you possibly tell me that this isn't a bubble? I mean, the thing has spiked so high it looks like a climbing wall. No, Bitcoin, it's bubble.
No, what this reflects, people are getting lost. No one uses it? Companies like Overstock use it. Virgin takes it. The Sacramento Kings takes it. Fortune takes it. Do you know that?
I mean, that's technically true. Yeah, you can buy Fortune magazine using Bitcoin. But I'm just saying, in general, I can't go walk across the street to the retail shop, the brick and mortar shop, and use Bitcoin. It's not that mainstream.
It doesn't matter. You're missing the bigger point.
Your life connected. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So do you know what a Bitcoin is? You might have heard that term. Is it the future of currency? You know, we live in an electronic age, don't we? I mean, I feel bad. I was at Mass today, and a guy comes down with a basket. I have no cash on me to throw into basket noon, and I'm thinking, I never have cash. I always used to have cash on me. Now I never, ever have cash. You know, I use my ATM or use a credit card. Everything is digital. And now with my iPhone, you know, I could, in theory, use Apple Pay, which I could simply just, you know, you put your fingerprint or punch in your code and you can scan your phone and check out. You don't even need your wallet or your ATM card or your credit card. It's all digital. And we take a look at currency today, right? You take a look at the problems that we're seeing with it being devalued. You know, the U.S. currency is no longer backed by gold. I have friends down in the great country of Venezuela. And that country is in free fall. It is in absolute turmoil. Venezuelans, some are trying to use Bitcoin mining to escape inflation. Now, Bitcoin mining, this is all new language, I think, for a lot of us, right? It's kind of a part of a growing underground effort in Venezuela to escape some of the worst effects of what is just a crippling economy. There's a political crisis down there. They've got runaway inflation. Their money is useless. The IMF says their inflation is going to reach 720% this year. I mean, it's insane. It is absolutely insane. And in warehouses and offices and homes, they call these people miners because what they're doing is they're using modified computers to perform these complex computations, and they're looking for digital transactions worldwide. They're mining for bitcoins. You know, and they're crunching, you know, the data to mine bitcoins. And it's a very popular tool right now to fight Venezuela's hyperinflation. But I want to talk about this with you for a little bit because, you know, you go to the store, you pull out your wallet, you usually pull out a piece of plastic, you know, you insert that, you swipe it. What happens? The computer takes over. It transfers the right amount from what, your bank account to the merchant's account. Everybody's happy. It's copacetic. That transaction is most likely taking place with what? American currency, right? The U.S. dollar, though it can happen in foreign currencies as well. But that dollar is going from your bank to the merchant's bank, probably through some other bank. So, you know, this is very much bank-dependent currency. But because of computer revolution, something's come along that could disrupt this whole banking process. And you probably have heard the term Bitcoin. I ran a piece on this not too long ago on my radio program because I find it fascinating. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. It's the first one. It was started back in 2010. Now there are 1,100 different kinds of cryptocurrencies. And I know this might be confusing, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about what this all means and whether or not it's the future. Bitcoin is considered a cryptocurrency because it uses basically a military grade cryptography to secure the transactions. And, you know, a lot of people use it on the dark web, a lot of drug, you know, and you know, I guess criminal type of activity takes place with it. But Bitcoin payment processing is conducted through private network computers. There's a movement right now to make it mainstream, you know, and every transaction is recorded in a public record known as a blockchain. We'll talk all about this. We'll talk about the pros and cons of it and whether or not, you know, this may be a form of transaction in your future. I'm joined this afternoon by somebody who knows this intimately, and I first heard him actually on Morning Air talk about this months ago, and I thought, well, I got to get him on the show. I know many of you are very familiar with Bill Ulivieri. He is the owner of Senecal Capital Management in Chicago, and you can check him out at senecalcapital.com. I want to put a disclaimer out here before we go to him. This is not investment advice from him, okay? And I think he would probably agree with that. But we do want to talk a little bit about what this means, how it's supported, and how it may be part of your future. And, Bill, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Drew. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
And I hope I didn't speak out of school, but I'm assuming you want everybody to know this is not, you know, investment advice, right?
Yes. As a state-registered investment advisor, not only do I have to always be careful what I say and couch things in you know, the compliance hat that I have to wear, but I just want to make sure that because I am talking about currency and we're talking about assets that are going up and down in value, there's a great temptation just to close your eyes and say, I'm going to buy Bitcoin as an investment. And I just want to take this episode, you know, as education for now.
Yeah.
And anything about, you know, investing in Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies right. Should be done on the side.
So let's do this. And folks, look, I'll open the phone. You're welcome to join me anytime you want during this conversation. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If you've got a question, a comment, if you're confused, if you have something you want to contribute, love to hear from you. But let's start with something that I don't understand, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't currency normally controlled by a government, a sovereign nation of some sort? It used to be backed by gold or some sort of other asset. How can someone just make up a currency that's outside of government control?
That is the beauty of Bitcoin, Drew. And honestly, the United States abandoned its gold standard in 1933. We were only on the gold standard for about 54 years. It was Nixon that finally closed the window to foreign ownership of the conversion of U.S. dollars to gold, you know, sometime in the 1970s. But it's true, Bitcoin is a currency that is not governed or run or censored, controlled by a nation state. It's not controlled by the United States as it does the U.S. dollar. It's outside the control of that. And what is currency? If anything, Bitcoin in the last 9 years, what it's done is it has asked us the question is, what is money? And we take it for granted that we know what money is. It's those little green things that are in our wallet. Or maybe it's what gets debited and credited using a credit card. But what money is, this store of value, this transactional ledger between you, the owner of Bitcoin or the owner of currency, and someone else that you're going to, you know, buy that beer from or a dinner or the grocery store. It's this transaction of money. You know, we're so used to it being auto-deposited in our checking account or automatically, you know, credited to our 401k on a monthly basis. I think we've forgotten what it means to have money and what it means to be money. Because, frankly, Drew, things run pretty smooth here in the United States. But you can't say that about Brazil and Venezuela and India and then Zimbabwe and many other nations. They don't take their currency for granted. They don't store money under their mattress because if it's worth 2% or 10% less the next day.
Wow. You know, it's I saw a graphic earlier today showing when Bitcoin was created, I think it was 2010, and they said if you would have invested just $100 in Bitcoin then, it would probably be worth over $5,000 today. And if you looked at other companies, and they showed you major companies, Twitter and other companies that trade for several hundred dollars, you know, today, this far outperformed it. It was like a skyscraper over a bunch of ranch homes. It was amazing. But I'm amazed because you don't hear about it, and this – you know, for a long time, there was kind of a shadow over this so-called digital currency because it was used on the dark web, wasn't it?
It was originally used for the wrong reason on the dark web, as most things are on the dark web, and it's kind of why they call it that. But, you know, primarily Bitcoin was just designed to be a it was always designed from its original white academic paper to be a person-to-person digital currency. That's what it was designed to do. And for the first time in history, we don't need an intermediary to we don't need a trusted party, third party, to verify the transaction. So in other words, when I most of the time, Drew, if I have a like an MP3 file or or a video file or something I want to share on the internet, I can create unlimited number of copies. Well, that doesn't work when you're sending people money. So if I send money to you, you know, someone else has to make sure that I'm not counterfeiting it, right? So Bitcoin has created this digital scarcity. It's a payment, it's a form of money and a settlement system all in one transaction. So when my account gets debited, your account gets credited.
Okay, let me hold you on the point, because I'm still not totally on board with this, and I hope it's not going over, you know, those who are listening as well as their head. I understand Bitcoin is just random bits of computer code, right? How does that have value? Some guy sits down and says, I'm going to create a new currency, and then the world says, okay, well, we'll go with what you have. Well, I put a few million in my bank while I'm at it, right? How did this come about? Was it a mathematician? What's the history behind this?
I think the history, Drew, is Bitcoin really is just the evolution of digital currencies and types of cryptography that had been experimented with since the early 1990s. It was a group called Cyberpunks. And they were always a bit of an anarchist kind of group. They didn't like the United States government. They didn't like the way NSA, for example, is monitoring all our phone calls. So they kind of always were already working outside the fringe. Right. But when you say Bitcoin is just a string of numbers, okay, well, so is digital radio, isn't it? Isn't digital radio merely O's and ones, yet it's broken up and is transmitted over the airwaves, and you and I can understand and we learn and we can do great things, right?
Right.
And every single SWIFT payment of the trillions of dollars that gets transacted in the worldwide banking system and bond payments in the stock market, it's all ones and zeros.
Yep.
So don't dismiss Bitcoin as merely a string of numbers, because so is everything else.
No, that's to me, it's fascinating. And I think we are moving in a direction where we will be using digital currency. You know, one day I was talking about Venezuela and how they are experiencing this hyperinflation down there. We take a look at currency here not necessarily being backed by gold anymore, as you point out. I guess, you know, there's some fundamentals about money that people need to understand, because currency is normally, as you point out, used to pay for something. But how can currency be used to pay for something unless we all agree that it has value? And I wonder where the monetary world is. You know, right now, hedge funds, other groups out there, when they look towards bitcoins, does it have the respect that gold, the U.S. dollar, other types of currencies currently have?
Well, I would say that that's a great question, Drew. And truthfully, Bitcoin is this amazing first attempt at an underlying technology called blockchain technology. So even if Bitcoin were to go to zero, people who believe in Bitcoin, they don't care, because the genie is out of the bottle for this distributed type of ledger, this transfer of payments. You have to understand, you know, as a former floor trader,
right,
the Chicago Board Options Exchange is potentially going to be listing Bitcoin futures and options maybe in the first quarter of next year. We have the Depository Clearing Corp, the company that's responsible for clearing all the settlements of stocks and bonds in the United States, which does, you know, billions of dollars of transactions a day, are looking at blockchain technology. So Bitcoin, again, Drew, you're right. Money is only what two people really decide it is.
Yeah.
My children, who are in their 20s, they don't even have a checkbook.
Right.
They Venmo everything. They do everything electronically. So for them, it's not so much of a stretch.
That's
but
so
for
true.
Us, who do things kind of old school, like you, I don't keep any money in my pocket.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens to me. When I pass someone on the street and I want to give a donation to someone, you know, shaking a coffee cup or throw something in the basket, I can't do it because I don't keep cash with me. And primarily, cash is only about 4% of the currency that's outstanding in the United States. their bank branches are closing down everywhere because nobody comes in and requests cash anymore.
It is interesting you say that because my kids do the same thing. I mean, everything is digital. I mean, they'll use Venmo or Square Cash or one of those types of apps now where people are paying for one another. You know, here, I'll give you the money you lent me, or here you go. Yeah, back and forth, it goes right into bank accounts. It's interesting. Hey, let me do this. I'm going to open the phones. We'll take some calls, too.
Sure.
Folks, I only have a few more moments on this topic. If you got a question, comment, if you are not clear, if you want to join the conversation, we're taking a look at cryptocurrencies, digital currency, the future of money, if you will. And your access to the show is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can get in right now with us. And there are some people, like I, you know, I saw this, that, man, it'd be great to invest in something like that. When you saw the return that this thing got in just a few years, it was insane. But I've also heard that Bitcoin will implode at some point in the future. You know, it's got a weak computer code or something in that line. Mm-hmm. If other cryptocurrencies succeed, you know, I wonder what happens to banks and especially central banks. In fact, you know, let me just share with you what the CEO of J.P. Morgan was arguing. He doesn't think that Bitcoin may be the best thing. I don't know. I think it's kind of cool. But here's what. And what's his last name? Is it Diamond?
Jamie Dimon.
Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan. This is what he said.
You know, Bitcoin can tell $100,000 of Bitcoin before it goes down. So this is not a advice on what you do. My daughter bought some Bitcoin and it went up, and she thinks she's a genius now. But it's I did refer to it as like the tulip bulb crisis of the 1700s, whatever. But here's the reason: governments, the first thing they do is form a currency. They like to control the currency. They control it through a central bank. They also like to know who has it, where it is, where it's going. Okay, and you just saw China just is closing down the Bitcoin exchanges. And what all I ever said is that at Bitcoin, the bigger these things get, the more governments right now, they look at it as a novelty. You know, they love in Washington, talk about, oh, this is, you know, technology, we love technology. Wait until someone gets hurt. Wait until it's used for illicit purposes, which it is somewhat used for illicit purposes. They close it down. That's my point. So it's not, you can argue there's, and I also said there's a good reason for it. If you're in Venezuela or Ecuador, or North Korea, you're better off probably using Bitcoin than using their currency.
That, of course, is the CEO of J.P. Morgan. And just a follow-up question on what he said. He says governments see this as a novelty, but they're going to get involved. Can governments get involved? Will they get involved? Is probably a better way of approaching that question. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I do, Drew. Governments will get involved. There definitely is a fear of money laundering and making transactions that are inappropriate. And I would say there's really two sides to the story. I like J.P. Morgan. I greatly respect, the firm. But at the same time, I think banks are shaking in their boots because Bitcoin transacts hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars a day without the need of a bank, right? So here, the person who's speaking is someone who has the most to lose if Bitcoin goes mainstream. So in the last 24 hours, there's been $2.7 billion of Bitcoin that has been transacted.
Right.
Over $6 billion in a 24-hour period is transacting person to person almost
crazy.
Instantaneously for virtually no fee outside of a bank.
That's amazing.
So put that in perspective.
All right. Well, great. My guest today, Bill Ulivieri. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. I have to pause just for a second. When we come back, lines are going to open. And we'll take your calls as we take a look at the future of currency. And I'm convinced it's going digital. Cryptocurrencies, which one will survive? We went from one, Bitcoin, kind of the first one out there. And now there are 1,100 of those. More when I return.
Too early for us to judge. We just need to embrace it.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Technology can be confusing.
You know, all the little Twitter faces and e-Twitters.
Technology problems.
I took my phone down to the basement. I got out a hatchet.
May even drive you to prayer.
Lord, we ask you to bless the computers because I can't figure them out.
Fire up the frustration-free, easy-to-navigate Relevant Radio app. The exclusive home of In Conversation with God. Reflections on the daily readings with insight from the saints. It's updated daily, so don't miss today's conversation. The Relevant Radio app.
October, the month of the Holy Rosary.
This was several years ago at our parish, and there was a father of a young daughter. She had to be about six or five. And at one point, I just felt like sharing with them this simple children's book that I had that I had used with my daughters when they were about that age. It was Pray the Rosary with a lot of pictures. And, you know, I just offered it to him. I said, we use this a lot, but I want you to have it. So he took it with his daughter. And then, you know, I'd see them at church here and there and whatever. And then it was a couple years after that I gave them the book. I went into Mass a little early. And he was at the back of the church with his eyes closed, holding his rosary, deep in prayer by himself. And it was just a very moving moment to me to see how God was working with him.
October, the month of the Holy Rosary.
This is Relevant Radio.
The Catholic story is being told, but being told by the wrong people in the wrong way.
Bishop Robert Barron has long been considered the modern Fulton J. Sheen, and that's somewhat true. But there are many differences between them, and Barron carries on the torch in new ways today. I'm Sheila Logminas. His ministry was named Word on Fire for a reason. His new book is titled To Light a Fire on the Earth. Bishop Robert Barron has ignited that, and he takes a closer look, 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific, here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
The Relevant Radio toll-free studio line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about their variety of life insurance options and annuity or retirement plans available at relevantradio.com. Keyword, Forester.
Your life, your finances, connected. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, 25 after the hour. Welcome back. Boy, what's in your wallet, right? That's an ad that runs right now on television. What will be in your wallet in the future? Will you have Benjis and Lincolns, or will it all be digital? I tend to think at some point it will be digital. And Bill, as you pointed out, my guest today, Bill Ulvaeri, folks, if you want to learn more about him too, check out his website. It's SenecaCapital.com. At Seneca Capital Management. He's located in Chicago, Illinois. Let me go to the phones, and then I want to ask you an investment question. You said you're not going to give investment advice, but I do want to throw something out at you. Let's go to Philly first. Let's go to Jane in Minnesota. Philly. Yeah, Lincoln from Philly. Good afternoon.
Drew, thanks for taking my call. A fascinating conversation. I think it's important to look at, you know, while Jamie Dimon did mention that it's a novelty, and you hear guys on Bloomberg talk about that, JPMC also is investing heavily in blockchain and cryptocurrencies. Yep. On different exchanges in different countries. So you got to watch what they do versus what they say. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it helps break down the friction. When you do a transaction, a lot of people have got their hands in the pie, and this allows the breakdown of the friction. If you wanted to donate money to somebody in Venezuela, if you wanted to donate money to somebody in the Sudan, it breaks down the friction and allows peer-to-peer giving, where money is going, you know, to a on the benevolency side, your money's used wisely. But I definitely think this has got a lot more traction than people are giving it credit for. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Well, hey, Lincoln, thanks for the call. Thanks for the input. And Bill, why don't you follow up with that too? Because I was going to ask you, is it a good idea to maybe put this into your portfolio?
I know we only have 3 minutes, Drew, so I'll have to go as fast as I can. So Lincoln brought up a very, very good idea, and that is, you know, we have to remember that this sort of transmission of digital currency, it's going to benefit the United States, but it's going to benefit poor people the most. We have 7 billion people on the planet. 2.5 billion of them don't have a credit card or access to a bank. They don't own the title to their own property. So you're going to see a global explosion in economic activity for the first time, because whether you're Mother Teresa's untouchable, whether you're man, woman, black, white, one of the Indian caste systems, if you're a woman in Pakistani who is not even allowed to walk into a bank without your husband or your father to open up a checking account or a banking account, you can participate in economic activity, buy and sell goods, and actually have a business and participate in something you are normally excluded from. Bitcoin doesn't care who you are, where you live, what your sex, religious affiliation, or anything is. It's completely Catholic. It's universal in the small c of the world, in the word. But in terms of owning Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, you know, we have to remember that the value of the currency, the value of the token, is based on how well it receives adoption. You know, Bitcoin's very popular because people are buying it and they're selling it and they're transacting with it, and that this creates this self-perpetuating kind of cycle of upward prices because there's a limited fixed number of Bitcoin that are out there. And when you create a cryptocurrency, you have to stake it. You have to create the limits of how many are going to be created, unlike, say, the U.S. government that wants to just print, you know, a few trillion dollars to bail out the banks. So it's a deflationary currency rather than inflationary currency.
So two questions here. Joel in Portland, Oregon, Jane in Minnesota, they're asking, you know, how's value controlled and what happens if the banks crash?
Well, the banks are not going to crash. Okay, Bitcoin might run side by side along with other cryptocurrencies. But ultimately, you and I still transact in U.S. dollars, Drew. So maybe the tollways, the entrance and exit ramp will still be the banks. But the major highway will be Bitcoin and other digital currencies, I think, for the most part. And what was the first question again?
Well, he was asking, how is the currency controlled, you know, the value of it controlled?
Supply and demand.
All right, Bill, let me hold it right there. Time is my enemy. Check out Bill Ulivieri, Seneca Capital Management, Chicago. I'll be back.
It's the time of year to buy a new or used car. To save you money, Relevant Radio partner Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is offering flexible financing options and quick approvals ahead of time, so you're set to drive home when you find the right car. Already have a car loan? Move it to Notre Dame FCU and still save money. Call now for quick auto loan approval, and both you and Relevant Radio will benefit. Call 800-522-6111. That's 800-522-6111.
Want more out of life? Catholic Order of Foresters has full and part-time insurance agent positions available now. Provide measurable financial support and value to your family and the community. This is a great opportunity for a career move or even part-time to supplement your current career. Call Mark to find out if Catholic Order of Foresters is the right career fit for you. Call 855-696-2085. That's 855-696-2085.
Joe Sikora.
Resilience. How do you actually come back when life pushes you down, when life is stepping all over you? Again, Paul spoke about, you know, being content, whatever the circumstances, you know, in Philippians chapter 4. I love that. You got to go to your faith because that's what's going to give you the strength, the resilience necessary to say, I can do this because I've got the strength given to me by God.
The Joe Sikora Show, 10 p.m. Eastern,
7 p.m. Pacific on Relevant Radio.
The Eucharist is precisely our redemption made present to us on the altar in the Mass so that we may surrender ourselves with Jesus Christ, our High Priest, as he gives himself to the Father. The Eucharist is the summation of the whole work of Christ's redemption, and it is the heart and essence of our life in Christ. As it says in the Catechism, it is the source and summit of our life.
This is Relevant Radio.
This is Franciscan Media's Saint of the Day for October 24th. Today we celebrate St. Anthony Mary Claret. Born in Spain in 1807, young Antonio learned his father's trade of weaving, as well as printing and Latin, all before studying for the priesthood. Ordained at 28, he went on to become one of Spain's most popular preachers. At 42, Anthony founded a religious institute of missionaries, known popularly as the Claretians. Appointed to head the much-neglected Archdiocese of Santiago, Cuba, he began its reform by almost ceaselessly preaching and hearing confessions. He incurred widespread opposition for preaching against unmarried persons living together and for giving instructions to black slaves. When a hired assassin slashed his face and wrist, Anthony responded by getting the would-be assassin's death sentence commuted to a prison term. All his life, Anthony was interested in the Catholic press. Residing with the Spanish colony in France, he founded the Religious Publishing House, a major publishing venture, and wrote or published 200 books and pamphlets. A staunch defender of the doctrine of papal infallibility at Vatican I, he died in 1870 and was canonized in 1950.
There's more about the saints along with the Saint of the Day app at relevantradio.com, keyword saint. Saint of the Day is a production of Franciscan Media.
One heart at a time.
Coming up on the next Inner Life, walking with loved ones who experience same-sex attraction. Father Nathan Reisman will be our spiritual director.
Extremely important to put all of our effort into making household sanctuaries of faith, of prayer, of dwelling places of God, and of passing on the faith to our kids.
I'm Chuck Neff, inviting you to join us for the next Inner Life, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Relevant Radio.
Anything that is beautiful, true, or good is a reflection of God who created those things. And so we can also be promoting God and promoting values that reflect spirituality and Christian approach to life by tweeting about those things that are beautiful, true, and good.
The truth ultimately wins out. Famously, Martin Luther King said that the arc of history bends towards justice, that also bends towards truth, because that which is a lie doesn't last. It ultimately collapses under its own weight as a falsehood. Only that which is true, beautiful, good, and that builds unity, that ultimately lasts.
Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things.
This is Relevant Radio.
Solitary confinement is the practice in so-called supermax prisons of holding inmates in a single cell for 22 or 23 hours a day for months or years on end. While some think the practice makes prisons safer and reduces violence, it may make prisoners more at risk for mental health problems. Some estimates say the number of inmates held in what is called SHU, special housing units, might be as high as 80,000 across the U.S. While it used to be used as a short-term punishment to crack down on violence, prisons now routinely use the practice. While stays used to be only a few days, some prisoners have been in solitary for years.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
25 now before the top of the hour. Welcome. So good to talk with you. I hope you enjoy the perspective we're able to give you here on so many of these different issues that sometimes fly under the radar, whether it is Bitcoin. We've talked death penalty in the past. I saw a very compelling piece on solitary confinement. You know, the church and civil society, we've been pushing away from the death penalty. And you know, we've talked about this a lot. So, well, in fact, we've even debated it on this program. But, you know, we still want to see violent criminals locked up. They should still do their time, right? They should. You know, a lot of people say, you know what, if you're not going to kill them, lock them up and throw the key away. That keeps them away from society at large. Of course, 95% of the people who go to prison eventually come out. And a prison society is completely different than the rest of society. So what happens when the criminal misbehaves when he's in prison? Well, a typical reaction in many prison systems is to put him in the hole. Right? Put that person into solitary confinement. Of course, for those outside of prison, you know, most people say, who cares if they're creating problems? What's wrong with that, right? He deserves it. Here's something very interesting to think about. Those prisoners who've been in solitary confinement, they have a much harder time adjusting to society after they get out. Remember, 95% of people who go to prison eventually come out. So what are the scars that come from this? According to the executive director of Colorado's Department of Corrections, an inmate will stay in solitary confinement, for two and a half years on average, but sometimes for decades, depending on their crime. And he says that inmates who have spent time in solitary confinement, they're more likely to reoffend than those who have not. And those who are locked away like this, they account for about half of all prison suicides. So that's scary. I mean, that really is scary. Listen to the piece that Oprah did on 60 Minutes. She interviewed those who were previously in solitary confinement, and they made it very clear that this was the farthest thing from paradise.
Hi there.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'm Oprah.
Hi, I'm Aaron. I know who you are.
Oh, hi, Aaron.
On the other side of that steel mesh, inmate Aaron Franklin is serving part of his 50 years to life sentence.
What did you get 50 years to life for?
For murder.
Murder.
It was the murder of a fellow gang member in San Diego. But crimes you commit on the outside don't get you sent to the Pelican Bay SHU. It is reserved for offenses committed once you're in prison.
Why were you brought here? Can you tell me?
Just a little misunderstanding on the yard.
That little misunderstanding was an attack on another inmate with a weapon, and it earned him a year in solitary confinement. Franklin is in what's known as a SHU pod, 8 tiny cells, 4 up and 4 down, all facing the same blank wall across the way.
It was created to break me, mentally, physically, and spiritually.
Danny Murillo, Troy Williams, and Steve Sifra all went to prison as teenagers. They were sent to the Pelican Bay SHU for what happened after they were behind bars. Steve spit on a prison guard. Troy was part of a riot at another facility. And Danny was accused of being in a prison gang.
Do you remember the first day you pulled up to the SHU, taking that long bus ride, getting off the bus, and seeing the place?
It's a big white building with a small little door. My imagination was a human slaughterhouse. People just going into a human slaughterhouse.
What did you think, Steve?
It was a modern-day dungeon. I had never seen anything like it.
The message is, you're not getting out of here.
All three ultimately did get out of the SHU and out of prison.
I think the feeling on the part of a lot of folks is that you committed a crime regardless of what age you were.
Exactly.
You got locked up. You deserved to be there. Can you tell me why we should care?
We are, most of us, going to be getting out. And it would behoove the public to begin to facilitate a healing, you know. And the healing can start with, you know, a basic dignity in how we're treated.
You know, we may not think of how we treat our prisoners as a real issue, but when you're looking at 2.3 million people who are behind bars today, and 2.2 million of them are going to eventually get out of prison, go back to society at large, I really think this is an important issue on a number of levels. We need to think about how we treat them. We also have to see the inherent dignity in them. And ultimately, reevaluate this. Pope Francis, and I hope I'm not speaking out of school. In fact, our chief religion correspondent can probably correct me on this when he joins me here in a second, talked about not just the death penalty, but Pope Francis said solitary confinement is kind of a form of torture. Joining me today to give us perspective is our chief religion correspondent here at Relevant Radio, also the president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland. Monsignor, thanks for your time. Good afternoon.
Drew, it's good to be with you. And also, thank you for taking up this topic. It's a difficult one to even talk about because it's unpopularity. But I do think Dostoevsky was right when he says the degree of civilization in a society is revealed by entering its prisons and how we treat the least among us. And obviously, prisoners are not the one people that think – people don't think of them first when thinking of those who should be treated with dignity. But that's the key to Catholic teaching about the human person, is that every person, no matter how serious a criminal they may be, never loses his or her human dignity.
Yeah, I was trying to recall the comment that Pope Francis made recently. I think he said that we as Christians, you know, are called to actually proactive, or to fight for the improvement of, you know, prison conditions in respect for the human dignity that those who've been, you know, deprived of that liberty, those who are in prison. And he went on to call, I think, solitary confinement kind of a form of torture. Am I correct in that? But know where he stands on death penalty. Where is he on solitary?
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, the United Nations in the so-called Mandela rules, you know, after Nelson Mandela was released from prison, there was a worldwide effort to look at having universal laws about what can and cannot be due to people justly in prison. And the Mandela rules say that no one should be confined, solitary confinement, more than 15 hours a day.
Yeah.
So these are the worldwide standards that, you know, the rest of the world has agreed to. And, you know, I keep up in my office a sign we use here a lot at Relevant Radio, give hope. And this is one of the things Pope Francis has said about how we treat prisoners. Everyone knows as Catholics that someone who has committed a serious crime, depriving them of their liberty and putting them in a place that defends society from their ongoing activity, especially if they're not reformed, is not unjustified. There, you know, that sentences can be just for people who have committed serious crime. But what Pope Francis says, and here I'm quoting him now, but let us not forget that for the punishment to be fruitful, it must have a horizon of hope. Otherwise, it is enclosed within itself and is only an instrument of torture. It's not fruitful. So that horizon of hope has to be there. Now, ultimately, as Christians, we know our horizon of hope is eternity. But the idea that the person that's being punished by having their liberty curtailed is not put into a situation which where they are further punished beyond that. So no one, for example, should be subject to physical or sexual assault in prison. They shouldn't be put in an environment where that is an everyday possibility. Right. They shouldn't be put into a kind of confinement that keeps them from having the normal human interactions that, is part of being a relational being, because we do not cease to be relational beings just because we committed a crime.
Gotcha. My guest today, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, will take your calls too. Maybe you worked in the industry. Maybe you were a prisoner. You know what it's like to be in the hole and what the culture's like. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you agree with this or disagree. You know, the phones are always open for you. Toll free here to join the conversation. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Iowa first. Anonymous is listening. Hi, Anonymous.
Good afternoon, Drew.
Good afternoon.
Glad I got in. First of all, I do want to let everyone know I'm totally against death penalty because I don't think it deters any crime at all whatsoever. Secondly, having worked in a prison, I will tell you that it is impossible with the staffing that they have at prisons now to let people out of the cell, especially if they're in solitary confinement, more than 1 hour at a time. We just don't have the staffing. I mean, you got to remember, it's a tax-funded system, and with the states with the tight budgets they have, the prisons are one of the last things funded. I mean, it's terrible. It really is. And we've just had, in the last 2 weeks, we've had two assaults on officers here in the state of Iowa.
Wow.
And there's some inmates that absolutely cannot be put in the general population. They are too violent to do it.
So is there an alternative to 23-hour lockup? I mean, it does seem kind of rough.
Well, I think there's a bigger picture. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let the guard answer.
The thing of it is you don't have the staff.
Right.
Right.
The staff isn't there to do it.
Yeah, I would love to ask this because I was just looking at a study from the New York University's law school, the Brennan Center there, which looked at our incarceration rate. But the United States has by far the largest incarceration rate of any country in the world. We even actually have more total prisoners in our system than China, which is much, much bigger than we do have in their system. So we lock up a lot of people. Their study is that about 39% of the people who are currently behind bars don't really need to be behind bars. And in many, many cultures wouldn't be behind or countries wouldn't be behind bars because they're nonviolent offenders, often to do with drugs. If we took 39% of the population and had them doing community service and drug rehabilitation and other things and not being housed in prisons, wouldn't that free up a lot of resources since it costs $31,000 a year to take care of a prisoner on average in the United States? About four students at Donnelly could go to school for that for every one prisoner. We could have four students here at Donnelly for that. So wouldn't it be better if we significantly reduce the prison population to make it like other civilized countries?
Oh, I agree with that 100%. I really do. I mean, there, like you say, there are a lot of them doing time that actually don't – that could serve better out in the community. And also I think that something else I don't care for is that once you've got that felony on your record, you don't get a job anywhere, you know. You're not. It's going to be hard to find a job,
right?
But on the same token, I mean, I've had my life threatened, I've had my family threatened.
Wow!
And most anybody that's ever worked in a prison has had the same thing. So, right. You know,
And
we're in there with nothing but maybe pepper spray at the most for a weapon.
Wow. Yeah.
Right, and there are some I do believe that we have to keep isolated. I think there's creative ways we might be able to have human interaction for some periods of time, even if it has to be behind glass, that plexiglass containment kind of thing. But they can still have interaction for the very worst, because I do think it is a form of torture to keep someone completely isolated from human contact for 23 hours a day. As the articles, Drew, you sent me about the a Colorado situation where one of the person in charge of the Colorado system did it. He went in to see what it was like, and he only made it 20 hours before he said this was basically cruel and unusual punishment.
I would drive myself crazy if I was in there. In fact, there are some who say, hey, lockup like that leads to mental illness. It leads to hallucinations. There was a piece done by the BBC in which volunteers also agreed to spend 3 days in solitary confinement. I don't know whether you'd be able to handle that or not. Can you do 3 days in solitary? It was literally startling to hear what happened to them. Listen to this.
The long hours without stimulation are creating some very strange experiences.
So I can see a pile of oyster shells. I hope someone can hear me. I'm hallucinating.
You'll just see moving shapes, lights, saw some little tiny cars.
A load of fighter planes buzzing around, and it's a swarm of mosquitoes.
In the dark room, people would be hallucinating because there's absolutely nothing to focus attention on. Now, in the absence of information, the human brain carries on working and processing information, even if there's no information to process. And after a while, it starts to create that information itself.
But they were not just visual hallucinations from which he was suffering.
I heard music. And it seemed to be coming into the cell. Yeah. But I knew it wasn't, but I heard it.
Monsignor, how long do you think you'd be able to withstand solitary?
Well, I always like to say I hope I could make it as a retreat, you know, and that kind of thing. But the thing is, you have to remember, in many of these situations, they don't let the prisoners have books. Right. They don't let them have, you know, any way of doing that. And either the light's on all the time or light's not on. I mean, these are things that are sort of the adding insult to injury. There are ways, again, of treating people with dignity while also keeping people safe. And I think this is one of the things I'm glad to hear the guard agreed with me, that we need to greatly reduce the amount of people behind bars. It's extraordinarily expensive. Yeah. It's unnecessary. And it's a waste of great human talent that can do things. Because someone has a drug problem doesn't mean they should be locked up.
Do we have so many – we're one of the more incarcerated nations in the world.
By far. I mean, in rate and in numbers both, absolute numbers and in incarceration rate per population.
Is it about money? Is that the bottom line? This is big business?
Well, some would say that. I think that the spike up went when we got tough on crime and tough on drugs, quote unquote. You know, the war on drugs went, and the two went together, and very, very a few other countries treat nonviolent drug offense the way we do. And I think we also have, unfortunately, locked up many people who are mentally ill and not competent for the crimes they have committed, because we don't have the mental health structures that most first world countries have.
Okay. Well, let's do this. You know how this show works. Time is the enemy. It goes so quickly, so little of it. Lines are stacked for you, Monsignor. So we'll start in the beautiful state of Georgia. Hi, Laura. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Drew. It's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you. I understand you're a medical person in prison?
Yes, actually I am. I am a nurse practitioner, mid-level provider, like a PA. And my job is I treat the patients when they come in to see me, the inmates. And they come into my office. I don't have any officers there or anything with me. But I'm just pretty much one-on-one with the guys. But I also have to do rounds every week in the hall. So I just basically go down there and see how they're doing, make sure they're okay. But we have nurses that go down there 3 times a day, too. Now, in our situation with the ISOSEG units, we have 3 of them, and we have quite a few inmates that go there, and they go there for different reasons. Sometimes it's behavioral issues. Other times it's for PC, which is protective custody, and these are the inmates that have been threatened or are easily victimized, or they actually choose to go into the hole, which you would think would be weird. Now, in our buildings, they live in a kind of a small room, but they have a window to the outside so they can see out, and also a flap in the door that they can, you know, they receive the food and stuff in, and they do get to go out for an hour or so every day to get outside and get some sunshine, fresh air, and stuff like that, provided we have the staff. Staffing is really, really bad in the prison systems. And if you heard about the two officers that were shot and killed a few months ago, those guys were actually from the prison I work at, and I actually knew them. It was sad. And actually, the guy that shot him, he was a patient of mine at one point. Wow. But he was in my office, so that was kind of weird. But a lot of these guys are hello?
Yeah, no, yes, we're listening. They? We're here. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. I heard a beep. Okay. Anyway, a lot of these guys are actually diagnosed with what's called ASPD, which is antisocial personality disorder, or another common term for that is sociopath. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are that way, and they will be very, very charming, very nice, and seem to be, you know, quite pleasant. And you're wondering, why in the world are they there? But they truly are sociopaths. They'll smile in your face and then, you know, do something the next minute to you. But and that's, unfortunately, we have quite a few of those guys. And to me, it's distressing, and it's sad, because what I see in the system is with these young men and some older men too, is great spiritual voids. Many of them just have no direction. Many of them, if they were ever taken to churches when they were really young, they don't know the Bible. Some guys do find God in prison. Unfortunately, we have a lot of them turning to Islam, but I think it's because they crave the structure and the discipline of that. But so kind of what I do is, if I feel so moved, I'll talk to them about that because I can. So if I feel like I need to, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but it just depends. But these guys in the ISO-SEG units, they don't seem to have issues as far as, you know, being extremely miserable in the ISO-SEG. Some of them seem quite content, believe it or not.
Yeah, those who are, and Monsignor, I'll let you follow up with her, but those who've committed murder, and I don't know whether the death penalty is, if Georgia's a death penalty state or not, but those who are...
I believe it is, but it's extremely rare.
So, but those guys, they're in solitary constantly, right? They're never let out, right?
No. Sometimes they go for, it depends on the offense. If they have contraband and stuff, they may go for a week or 2 weeks or 30 days or something. And some people go for a little bit longer, depending. If they've raped another inmate or something, they'll go for quite a bit longer, or that kind of thing. Or, you know, they've tried to hurt somebody. We've had some pretty violent offenses by some of these guys. Some are things that you don't want to really hear about. Yeah. But, you know, they come in. One of my jobs is to go sew them up when they come in the ER with stab wounds and stuff like that, or they're beaten up and fighting. Wow. That does happen. But, you know, it is what it is. And some of these people I really wouldn't want to see on the street, to be honest.
And Monsignor, I'll let you follow up. We only have a few moments here, yeah. Lars. So let Monsignor follow up.
Yeah, no, the God bless the nurse for what she does.
Great to hear from her.
You know, and college, we go into prison and teach. And this is one of the things that I wanted to make sure we say. There are things we can do. The Brothers in Blue and others that go in and preach the gospel and serve, and the people who go in and do education in prison, we find we have a recidivism rate, the people who take our courses in prison, of less than 2%, when in many systems it's well over 40, 50%, because we give them something constructive to do while they're in prison, and we also prepare them for getting out of prison. by doing education, doing the associate degree in prison. Right now, no government money can be used for that kind of program. And that's a tragedy because if someone doesn't have anything better to do in prison, they're just going to become better criminals. They're going to learn from the people around them. But if we give them things to do, we've shown that it works in rehabilitating people. And it's better for society. It's better for us that the people who come out of prison are in better shape when they come out than when they went in. Unfortunately, what the studies are showing, especially those in solitary, they're in a much worse position when they come out, when they went in, when it comes to their mental health
right.
and their ability to integrate in society.
Well, I agree. We have that actually, those programs in our prison as well, which are wonderful. We have faith-based and integrity programs and educational programs, and also they get jobs too. So it's really a really good program. In my opinion.
Well, Laura, thank you for your service there and for being a witness to Christ as well. And I appreciate you listening and, of course, sharing with us today. Have a great day and stay safe, okay?
And thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, God bless her. You know, Matthew 25 just comes so strongly here. I was in prison and you visited me.
Yeah.
As a church, this is the challenge to reach to the poorest of the poor and those who are sometimes difficult to love. You know, Mother Teresa calls it the distressing disguise of Jesus present in the poor and the imprisoned. It can be a distressing disguise, but to serve Christ there is a great and wonderful thing that we must do. The gospel demands it of us.
I'm with you. I had a friend very close to me who did 6 years in a maximum security prison, and it changed my perspective, and it really is a beautiful corporal work of mercy. Folks, I would encourage you to maybe consider that. Not only just pray, maybe visit those who are in prison. My thanks to Monsignor Stuart Swetland. I'm Drew Mariani. Until we talk again, remember God loves you, and so do I. Have a great day.